Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahulastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello! You've just caught me on the set of 1980s Blankety Blank. I've travelled back in time to present that show. It's a very big break for me. Plus, time travel's been invented, but we are mainly using it to put 21st century people in 20th century game shows. But yeah, it's very confusing for Annika Rice, I have to say, who doesn't know who I am in the 1980s, obviously, because even if she knew me, I would have been a teenager. It's crazy. Anyway, welcome to another episode of Rahulastapa, this week with the amazing and super brainy historian Bethany Hughes. If you're watching this on video, I am crystal clear with my HD camera, and Bethany Hughes looks like she is living in some kind of swamp because her camera is not as good. And that is the way round you want it. You want to see me very clearly and Bethany Hughes like some kind of ghost from the past who's managed to somehow get here to our future from ancient Greece. She's amazing. It's a brilliant show, regardless of the video quality. Thanks to everyone for supporting the Stone Clearer Kickstarter, which amazingly hit its target last weekend. Thank you very much. We are doing another one, which will start imminently, for self-playing snooker with an amazing Punani album of 40 stickers that you can collect and swap. Of all the 32 self-playing snooker players, plus loads of stats, all sorts of things. It's going to be amazing, and some other brilliant rewards on top of that as well. Go to rahulastapa.co.uk/Kickstarter, and that should be starting up at some point the week of transmission of this podcast. And very excitingly, all the profit from that podcast will go to the Save Live Comedy charity, which is attempting to put some money back into clubs so that there will be some clubs open when comedy can return, if that is ever allowed. I mean, obviously, there's stuff online, but could we call this comedy? I don't know if we can. I don't know if we're allowed under present government regulations. So thank you. Please do support that if you want to help live comedy. And they're fantastic rewards. I think you will enjoy them if you're a fan of self-playing snooker or have enjoyed the summer of sport that I've given you here on Twitch. Self-playing snooker is now going weekly, me one versus me two snooker, as is Ali and Herring's Twitch of Fun, of course. Don't miss out on that. And Rahalaspa still being recorded every Wednesday at 8 p.m. on twitch.tv/rkherring. Do tune in. It's getting ever more professional, at least at my end. Let's sit back, relax, and enjoy Rahalaspa with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Bettany Hughes. Hello, please welcome a man who has arguing with his wife about eggs. It's Richard Herring. Please, hello, everyone. Welcome to another live streamed episode on Twitch of Richard Herring's Lopping Shells Tops Off podcast. I'm going to talk a lot about how to eat soft-boiled eggs on this podcast. That is why I've renamed it that. Though I was talking to the cleaners on London Underground the other day, the ones who cleaned off all of Banks's graffiti. They knew what they were doing. They did it for me. They knew that he'd nicked my idea for the Bristol statue. Someone else has nicked his idea and done it. And it's my idea anyway. Anyway, the cleaners call it Rahalaspa, so I don't know if that's going to catch on. All very exciting, having a lovely time. It's July as we record. I turned 53. At the weekend, which was quite an unpleasant experience. Actually, it was a lovely party, and I got my annual call from Barry Cryer, who was meant to be a guest on this podcast last year and then didn't do it, and I hope to have him on the podcast on the future. But he's a very nice elderly man who rings up young comedians on their birthdays, checks how they are and tells them a joke. His joke, which I won't do justice to, that it was a topical joke, said just before the lockdown, some people were lucky to get a flight back to England from abroad, and they were in the streets and they were excited. The captain came on the intercom and said, the flight will be arriving at Heathrow at 6:30 p.m. I am currently working from home. That was Barry Cryer's joke that I got for my birthday, so I thought I'd share that with you. I didn't do it justice. He did it much better than me. I've got a lot to tell you about. Before we start, I've got to talk to you about boiled eggs, because we had soft-boiled eggs for breakfast the other day, and we don't do that too often. It was my birthday breakfast, actually, and I hadn't realized until quite recently the way my wife opens boiled eggs is a blasphemy and against all God and nature. This is why you should really get to know someone properly before you marry them. And me and my wife only had 4 years of courting, including 2 years of living together. And that was not enough time. I should have waited until I knew her properly. Marry in haste, repent at leisure. I know there's a bit in Gulliver's Travels about a society at war over which way up a boiled egg should be eaten, but I don't care about that. That's ridiculous. It's crazy to go to war over something that trivial. What my wife does is way worse, and I think justifies a nuclear strike. Rather than what the way to eat a boiled egg, right? It doesn't matter which way up. You just lop the top off and then you're in, right? My wife, she taps it with a spoon like it's a hard-boiled egg, peels and starts peeling off all the bits individually. But it isn't a hard-boiled egg. It's a soft-boiled egg. And she's doing this, and all the bits of little eggs are ending up on a plate where her soldiers are and, getting in the egg. I know you're wondering how you avoid getting all those bits caught up in when you're dipping in your mouth. And the answer is you don't. She's insane. And yet I'm married to her, and now there's no way out of this. I think I'd have the strength to get through all of this, but the problem is that without me noticing, she has taught my kids that that is the correct way to eat a boiled egg. She's passed this curse on to another generation. They won't listen to me and do it the proper way like I tell them. And I can't prevent them. I can't prevent them ending up with a mouthful of eggshell. If I was a younger man, I would just leave this broken family and try again and meet a woman who eats soft boiled eggs correctly. But it's too late. Perhaps I can uncondition them, or at least the youngest one. But I don't think so. All I can do to try to entreat to any of you who aren't married not to make the same mistake I did, please use your courting time properly. I also discovered on my birthday that my wife didn't know what Flying Ant Day was. There was flying ants coming out of a step at the back of my mother-in-law's house. Nobody in my wife's family knew that that was a thing. And they go, what's Flying Ant Day? What are flying ants? They'd never seen them before. They didn't know there was a special day that happened. I'm pretty sure my wife's an alien from another planet. She's been sent to breed with the prime specimen of masculinity on planet Earth, and that is me. All right, we'll save that for. I've got another routine. I'm going to save that for another time because I'm full of ideas. It's all going very well. If you're watching on Twitch, remember you can subscribe on Twitch. If you're with Amazon Prime, you can subscribe for free and give me money without any cost to yourself. It's crazy, but please do it. You can become a monthly badger. If you want to give me some money, go fasterstrike.com/badges. Let's crack on. We've got a fantastic guest for you today. She is probably best known for playing Maddie in Dirty Linen in the Burton Taylor Rooms at Oxford in 1987. That's why we're all here. If you'd seen her in that, that would be why you were here. I believe me, it was amazing. Ladies and gentlemen, it's the historian Bettany Hughes. Here she is. How are you doing?
Very good, thank you. Good. And horrified that you remember that.
How could I not? It was the most it's one of the most incredible experiences of my life. I was also in that play with you, although I was in the play within a play.
Yes.
But you spent, well, my memory of it is, my only memory of it, of anything apart from my bit, which was independently, was you coming in the first dress rehearsal where you were dressed in just like underwear and corset and underwear,
yes,
and stockings and suspenders.
Yeah.
And I was a very innocent 19-year-old boy at this time. I believe when I met you, I was still a virgin. After we'd finished the play, I don't think I was a virgin anymore. But
nothing to do with me.
It was nothing to do with you. But I was too embarrassed to even look at you, but it's still somehow the image is still seared on my brain. You were very good. Did you do any more... Acting after.
I did loads. I say of all things to remember, we should just explain why I turned up in the dress rehearsal in a corset and suspenders. It's because that is what I was supposed to be wearing in the play. It wasn't just to kind of grab a bit of attention before we went.
It was a play about the Foreign Office or something like that, wasn't it? Or the government, and you were a secretary who kept coming. It's a very old fashioned. It's a Tom Stoppard play.
Tom Stoppard, but it's weirdly feminist, isn't it? Because it's going how everybody thought of secretaries. So we just did. I remember thinking, this is so modern. This is so kind of fresh. I didn't realise it was actually quite old-fashioned when I did it. Acting. Well, it's interesting because my mum and dear departed dad were both actors. So I grew up in that world. So I knew that although it's an incredibly important value, and I have to say, you know, I really do love actors and what they do is amazing to share stories and ideas and other kind of ways of being with the world. I do also remember that my life was spent with us basically sitting around the kitchen table drinking cups of tea because there wasn't much work available. Yeah. So, you know, we eked out the cups of tea. But it was fun, you know, what a way to grow up. So we just talked. That's all we did, is we just talked and talked and talked, and they hoped they would get work. So I loved acting. I did think, though, it probably wasn't the most sensible way to so I chose to be a historian, which of course is an incredibly you know, not lucrative way to spend your life. And it was also it was really do you remember what were you studying at uni?
I studied history, although I just did comedy and acting the whole way through.
Yes.
So, yeah, I didn't really do it.
So we should know that because we obviously should have been in the library together.
I think you might have been in the year above me. We're the same actual age, but I had a year off. So I think you were in the year above me. So I think we probably did. You know, you wouldn't have seen me in the library. I went to one lecture in the entire time I was there.
Did you?
And copied other people's essays every week and gave... my tutor must have known.
You're very wicked.
I, like, literally copied them word for word. And then I got away with it. I don't know how.
Yes.
But it was a weird that the when we did Dirty Linen, I think it was the first play I did in Oxford. But the week I did that, I missed my granddad's funeral because it was at the same time. So my granddad died, and the same week I lost my virginity finally, and it was very late. I was very nearly 20. It wasn't connected to my granddad dying. I don't think it was a pity shag. I don't think the person knew my granddad had died, but it was. Yeah, so it was quite a big week that week, or that 10 days, where I lost my granddad, lost my virginity, and appeared in a play with you in your underwear.
In a red corset.
So I became a man.
In every way. Blimey, what? That is a... Well, you were very good then. You never let on about it. I don't remember there being sort of, you know, tears and hankies in the backstage. But what I was going to say is, do you remember, though, if we were...
Was that for the losing my virginity or losing my granddad?
All of them.
There was hankies.
Hankies. Let's go back to history, away from hankies. But do you remember then, it was really unfashionable history. I remember people going, you are mad. You know, you're going to end up in this sort of dead-end job studying these dead-end people who are dead and dead languages. And it was very uncool history.
Yeah.
Then, so we had to really fight. I think it was almost, I wondered about it a bit, actually. I think it might be because of the year 2000 sort of vaguely approaching, and people all thought all the answers lay in the future and the past was under. Do you know what I mean? There was this sort of...
Yeah.
It was almost like a bad smell if you said that you studied history. So anyway, I stuck at it, stuck at the...
Yes. Were you doing ancient history at university?
Ancient, modern. I didn't do ancient.
I'm quite interested in Rome, and I was very interested in archaeology, and I love Pompeii, which I know you've been to many times. And are you doing a new show about Pompeii coming up?
It's actually just gone out. So we were looking at some of the new digs there, but I am going back. I do love it.
But yeah, I don't really know it. It's been very interesting listening to your audiobook and watching your show, because I don't know very much about ancient Greece. Beyond that, they had sex with little boys back then. That was the way they got their kicks. Is that true that they had sex with boys?
Well, they did have. There's lots of male, man on man and man on boy loving. It's disputed whether it was penetrative sex or whether it was intercrural between the thighs. This is this big debate that goes on. But they were definitely...
A lot of people are using that excuse in show business at the moment.
God, don't. But it was, it was very, it was completely, it was sort of this institutionalized idea of the older male bestowing wisdom, and glory and learning on the younger boy. But we're not talking about tiny boys, there was just a completely different attitude to sex and sexuality and the point of sex and what it was. And it was a lot more, what I love about kind of exploring those worlds is that we think we're so modern and that we have all the ideas. And of course, they had those ideas 3,000 years ago. So the whole non-binary sexuality thing, that was huge in the very early ancient world, in the Bronze Age world particularly, this notion that you could be both a man and a woman at the same time, and we're all a bit male and all a bit female, and they just knew that was the case and went with it. So it's taken us kind of 3,000 years to catch up and work out that might be a possibility.
Well, that's the fact that your book, your latest book, I know you've done several books, I've listened to the audio, but Venus and Aphrodite, A Biography of Desire, it sort of is about that, isn't it? What's interesting, I think, about that book is I thought, well, how can you write a book about something that isn't, Venus isn't real, that's just made up. But actually, of course, via the gods and the way that gods changed over time and the way they're depicted, you learn so much about the societies that the gods were, that were worshipping those gods and the way that they were changing. And it's absolutely fascinating book. And I think that's the really interesting thing about it, the way that both the sort of relationship between the sexes, but also sexuality has changed through that time. And, this is something I'm quite interested in, the sort of prehistory of sex and the way that the early gods were often female. And then it sort of got to a point where there was male and female. And then we got into these monotheistic gods where the men were all in charge. But that sort of was happening through the ancient Greek times, wasn't it? That it sort of, we arrived at Zeus being the main god when it had all been quite an even male and female mix.
Yeah, Zeus is a kind of a latecomer, really. So we've got this idea, exactly as you said, this sort of Olympian pantheon and Zeus on top and king of the gods, and then these other smiting gods all around in different, in different cultures. But that is not how it starts. So Zeus starts off, I love the fact, our earliest examples of Zeus are these tiny little sort of puny figurines, and he's kind of raising his fist, sort of trying to be almighty. Because it was definitely, I don't think that there was a kind of matriarchy in this. People sometimes talk about this kind of proto-feminist wonderland with women in charge. I think that absolutely wasn't the case. And I don't think there was a single mother goddess. But exactly as you said, it was a lot more mixed up and, a lot more surprising with Aphrodite. We think, when we say Venus or Aphrodite, we think of this kind of beautiful, wafty, blonde creature in a kind of pink, like a bit chocolate box pretty, basically. I mean, if you look at the early Aphrodites, she's a war goddess. She's a goddess of death as well as of life. The kind of very early versions of her from Cyprus are these weird creatures that have got basically a penis for a head and, you know, lovely.
I've got a question about that.
Boobs, I know.
That's one of my emergency questions, but yeah, carry on.
Was it? Yeah. Well, I will. I mean, you know, aren't they? Everybody's got to Google the Lady of Lemba now we're talking about him, her. Yeah. I mean, there's the most extraordinary images and with little eyes, you know, on the top of the penis. So, and that is Aphrodite. So, so she was sort of male and female and all about fertility, but all about, I think she's all about, kind of what we do with desire, us wanting what we haven't got. And quite often in the ancient world, that was wanting somebody else's village or territory. So it meant that you had to kind of rustle up an army or warriors to go and attack it. So it sort of makes sense that that desire-y thing, that female desiringness, was actually very aggressive in the early kind of early times of civilization. But you're right, those gods and goddesses, you know, there was much more equity. They were very, the goddesses were very, very feisty. And it's only later when we get kind of towards the end of the Bronze Age where there's a sort of systematic thing that basically we get greedy, I reckon, as a civil, you know, what we are as humans, we always want what we haven't got. Sure. And so we sit in like Tiryns or Mycenae or Argos and we think we've got this and it's amazing. Wouldn't it be lovely if we had over the hill as well? And if you're going to get over the hill as well, then you need to have an army. So suddenly it makes much more sense to worship a warrior god and to really kind of elevate warrior status. So that's about 600 years of human history condensed into six sentences. But you do then see that, and you see the goddesses getting demoted. You see women in society who had a lot of power and status and standing becoming slightly less influential. So I do think it, you know, all of that is it's not about belligerence, but it is about wanting more. And the easiest way to have what you want is to go and nick it from somebody with your soldiers.
Sure. And I think it's because people look back to obviously Stone Age man, and the image that people have is the men going out and hunting and bonking women over the head and, you know, taking them, and the women collecting berries. But I think, I mean, it's not, there's no real evidence, but we don't know for sure. But it seems likely from observing hunter-gatherer tribes now and from this evidence, this sort of god evidence, that it was a much more equal society before all this happened, agriculture and war and everything.
Yeah, well, I mean, you certainly see kind of in the bone evidence, you see a lot of the women and children, they have often kind of as much evidence of attack as the men. So, you know, they're definitely being out there, being pushed out to fight as well as you, exactly. They're not just sitting there and farming. I mean, you know, again, I think it's a real danger, isn't it, with history, that you find what you want to find. And we've always got to not do that. I think, oh, isn't that interesting? These gorgeous, strong, feisty women. There they are. But it makes sense, doesn't it? If you've got tiny populations as well, of course, 50% of them, i.e. the women, they're going to be put to use in the best way for that society. And often that is going to be to defend them or to attack in order to get food. So, yeah, so it's a really... I love looking at these goddesses because kind of by definition, they're immortal. So it's like they take you by the hand and lead you back through these thousands of years of history. And forgive me if there's anybody who's a goddess worshipper who's listening to this, but I do think they're made up. So what the ancients basically do is they take something that's important and they like desire, and they give it a name and a face, like Aphrodite or Venus, and then that is the idea that's being worshipped rather than the deity.
And I think the point you make in the book as well, which is great, is that, you know, in those days, it wasn't like people walk around going, well, actually, I don't believe in this, I'm an atheist. It was almost not really a choice. It was the only way to make sense of their world, and life was so short and brutal. And, you know, that these gods were sort of necessary to kind of keep people going through, to make sense of their world. They needed to think, why am I getting these feelings of lust? You know, I'm in a relationship and I'm lusting after someone else. Oh, it's because I've been enchanted by this goddess or whatever, you know. So it's...
Yes. Well, there is a lot of that that goes on the internet. Like, oh, it wasn't me. I really didn't want to say it. It was all to do with Venus, who's sitting over there. But no, you're completely right. I mean, the Greeks kind of famously don't really have another word for religion. For them, the gods and goddesses and demigods and spirits are everywhere and in everything, you know, in every fruit that ripens on the tree and every breath of wind. So they're asking a Greek if he or she believed in the gods would be sort of like asking them if they believed in the sea. You know, they were as real. Later, there are atheos, atheists, it's a Greek word, it's an ancient Greek word, which means people who sort of, you know, explored what that was. But definitely early on, there's this much more kind of mystical animist idea of the world where the supernatural is as important and prevalent and real as the natural.
Yeah, and it's just fascinating. I think the way once you've got that broad scope of history, though, the way those gods change in order to accommodate, you know, both taking over different countries and different civilizations, but also to reflect the changes in society. So it's a very interesting journey, this Aphrodite to Venus to, you know, and obviously into Rome with Taker, and you get a bit more evidence, and she's become this glamorous almost. It's almost like she's almost the porn hub of the Roman world.
Yeah, well, she
with the statues. Yeah,
yeah, definitely. So then you've got this very sort of potent Bronze Age goddess who you would have feared and you would have absolutely kind of insulted at your peril. Then she has this interesting kind of phase where she goes through, as I said, that she's both male and female. So you have Aphrodite with a beard in a lot of the figurines in Cyprus. So beautiful breasts and this kind of fantastic bushy beard. Then she's this kind of potent creature for the Greeks. But as you say, it's sort of slowly from about the 4th century BCE onwards, she basically starts to lose her clothes. So there's that very famous Venus, a bit like Maddie in Tom Stoppard.
Yes, yes. You should have based it all around that.
Exactly. Obviously, that was what was actually going on. But no, she does. So she suddenly becomes this kind of naked, rather than a kind of fabulously proud naked goddess. She's this goddess, the famous Cnidian Aphrodite. So she's sort of, I'm trying to just gesticulate, yeah, almost be a Cnidian Aphrodite. But, you know, she's sort of half covering her breasts and half covering her vulva, but it's sort of covering and yet pointing. You know, it's sort of, yeah, I'm a bit ashamed of this, but look, isn't this lovely what I'm ashamed of? And it's really from that moment onwards, as you say, that she becomes an excuse for kind of flesh on show and sculpting these kind of 3D images of the naked female form. And then the Romans, being Romans, keep that. So they make her naked, but they give her her armour back. So she's sort of every male fantasy. So she's naked with a helmet and a sword. You know, that's how the Romans often liked her. So
that's how the empire got so big. That's why it took over the world. Well, they knew what men were like.
Well, and Venus, they think of Venus as their mother, don't they? If you think that this whole story about Venus giving birth to Aeneas, who then, you know, his descendants go on, Romulus and Remus go on to found Rome. So for the Romans, Venus, this sort of fighting, naked, swordy goddess, is the mother of Rome itself. Yeah.
Again, very like Pornhub. That's what most of Pornhub is.
I wouldn't know.
No, nor would I. I mean, I'm guessing. And I'll move on to the TV show in a sec, but I highly recommend this Venus and Aphrodite, A Biography of Desire. The audio book, which you read yourself, which I always love, fantastic. I love the love of the little details of history. I'm very interested in archaeology, but what I quite like is throughout this book, you keep on mentioning little fragments of poems and plays that have made it from ancient Greece on, you know, in often just on bits of wrapping up of other books or just little fragments found in Egypt or the desert or whatever. It's that's sort of so fascinating to me that like a passage or a poem, a bit of a poem,
yeah,
can exist and then you can still work out who wrote it or where it came from or have an idea of what it was. And
yeah, well, absolutely.
Do you have it? Go on, sorry.
What I was going to say is kind of famously the examples of that are these beautiful, beautiful little fragments of Sappho, of the poetry of Sappho, that I kept in Oxford in the Sackler Library, some of them still in the biscuit tins, the Huntley and Palmer sort of ginger nut tins that they were first put in at the turn of the 20th century. And they're the size of my fingernail, but incredibly methodically. If you piece those together, you can recognise a new line of Sappho, and sometimes you can, you know, that's how you identify her work, because there's a particular scribe that loved copying out Sappho, so you can kind of recognise the handwriting. But yeah, you're right. I mean, you know, if I had my way, Sappho, Sapphic love would be taught in all schools, and I I mean that in the most helpful way, because she's, you know, what an amazing female poet, you know, 2600 years old, and she's the first person to talk about love as being bittersweet, although she says she's a bit more realistic and she says it's sweet and then bitter but you know, that sort of understanding of love, and she talks about the fire, the passion sort of burning under your skin, and your kind of longing for how you just can't get people out of your head, all of that. I genuinely think that'd be so helpful to teach in schools, to go, look, I know that you're feeling like this. There was this woman 2,600 years ago on Lesbos who felt exactly the same. So, you know, it makes you realise you're not alone.
And do you think, is there anything that's lost that you kind of know that there's a lot of it out there? Because there's things in Pompeii, aren't there? The libraries in Pompeii that are kind of, the scrolls are all charred, but they're finding ways to read them and discover what they are. Is there something you would love to find in one of those libraries particularly?
Oh, I mean, what a brilliant question. You know, we will find all kinds of things. We will find new plays of Euripides. We will find lost gospels. There's absolutely no doubt. So basically, everything you hope you will find will be found at some point. I always love that about history. Unless it's been destroyed, it's there. Do you know what I mean? It's just lost somewhere. Yeah. It actually hasn't been destroyed. So it's just waiting. It's waiting to be found.
Yeah. Well, good. It's. I think looking at the human race via sexual desire is such, you know, such an important part of it. And it's often not mentioned in history, which is often seen as a very dry thing. But obviously it's one of the driving impetuses of humanity. And it's so sort of important. And to see, I think that point again you make in the book that you made just earlier as well about, but the binary nature and the acceptance of different lifestyles in at that time, and the way it goes back and forth and things become forbidden, and there was a sort of freedom there that I think largely was a good thing. I'm not, some of it seems a bit weird to our modernize, but it is fascinating that they had that discussion 2,000-3,000 years ago, and we're still discussing it now.
Yes.
But hopefully that means does that mean that we just will never learn, that it just keeps going around in circles and we keep fighting back and losing knowledge and gaining knowledge?
Yeah. I don't think we ever completely lose it. We forget how to be wise sometimes, don't we? So.
Yeah. What a shame.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Good. Well, I'll ask you, this is an emergency question that I think is very apt for you. Again, this is quite a tricky one for someone who has such a love of history. But something I ask pretty much everyone recently is, if all the museums and art galleries in the world got together
and said, we're going to give you one thing that you're allowed to take home and keep, one item, one, it could be a painting, but it can obviously be an historical artifact. Which thing would you like to take home and own from all of the
Richard
museums in the world? I know it's difficult. I bet there's something though.
Well, you see, isn't it interesting? Maybe what springs to mind. And it's not incredibly original, but I just do love her. So she is the so-called snake goddess from Crete, from Minoan Crete, and possibly badly restored, but this incredibly feisty creature who stands there grappling snakes with a bare breast, these beautiful sort of erect black nipples, and you know, this kind of little cinched in waist and staring out with coal rimmed eyes. And I just love her. I tell you why I love her particularly, because she's one of the reasons I became a historian. Because I remember our classics or history teacher putting a sort of rubbish slide of her, black and white, scratched slide up, kind of in the early 80s, and saying, we've got no idea who she is. We don't know whether she's a goddess or a priestess or an ordinary woman, but she was buried as though she was radioactive waste. And I thought, that is so I want to spend my life trying to find out. So I think she would probably be who I would take home, and I would force her to tell me her secrets. But they were, I mean, they were heady times, those. I've just been on this Greek Odyssey that I'm doing, we've just been looking again at these amazing like vats of laudanum that they used to mix up. So opiates and alcohol, and some of them have been left in women's graves. And we know, so these aristocratic women of the time were mixing up this incredibly druggy brew and tripping on it and imagining, I'm sure that's where some of the stories of the myths come from, and also making people forget their sorrows. And a lot of those goddesses, so-called goddesses, priestesses, have opium poppies in their headdresses. So, you know, party girls.
Well, I've been watching the Greek Island Odyssey today. I've seen a good chunk of the whole series.
Good man.
There's still one more to come, is it? Is there one more coming out on Friday?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But it's all available on MyFive, so you can go and catch up on the whole thing if you're interested. I mean, it looks like a lot of fun to make. My mum and dad found out you're coming on and said that they love this series.
Thank you so much to Mr. and Mrs. They're
big fans. Oh. It looked like, these things always look like fun, and I'm sure they're not as much fun as they look, but basically it's you swanning around Greece on a yacht, eating nice food, getting drunk with nice people, flirting a bit with all the handsome sailors and stuff.
Yeah.
It looked like quite a nice job to do.
Not bad.
Because it's good. You've got the history, but it's also you're very much luxuriating in the beauty of the landscape. I mean, I've never been to Greece at all, or any of the Greek islands.
Richard,
I know
that is. Absolutely, well, I like Italy. Well, I'm going to come to Greece. It's where it all begins. After this series, I have to say, I think the bookings to Greece, despite the slightly sad fact that nobody could get there until this weekend, has apparently gone absolutely soaring. Oh, I know. I mean, I'm so lucky to do it. I've been going there for 30 years. And so I've got lots of very, very, very old friends there. So I kind of get a beautiful, warm welcome when I go. And for me as a historian, it's amazing because they go, welcome, and have a look at this, what's just been discovered, you know. So I get taken to some amazing things. Oh no, it was a total delight. But it really, because we're sort of retracing Odysseus's route from Troy back to his homeland in Ithaca, and I have to say, we thought we would try to make it not too easy for ourselves. So rather than just go in the summer, we had this bright idea of going over winter, because we thought then, you know, we'll experience some of those sea storms like Odysseus did. Well, and if you've been watching the show, we did.
Yes, you did.
we really did. So,
I mean, you're incredible. I have to say, you look incredibly blasé and brave, I thought, as it was going, oh, when the waves started going at 6 metres high, and you're still sort of lying on the front of this yacht, and then finally you come inside. I'm thinking, yeah.
I know.
People being sick over the side. The cameraman's being sick.
No, the cameraman wasn't being sick. The sound man was being sick. The cameraman ended up helping to crew the boat, basically. So I know that was quite an adventure. But, you know, it is really interesting. Lots of people said, were you scared? Because they really were. You know, the swell was massive, and we were sailing at night. And, you know, it did feel quite hardcore. And everybody was being sick, apart from me, the cameraman, and my female director, who was sort of became, even though actually none of us are properly British, but we came ridiculously British and just talked about, if only we had a gin and tonic, it would, you know, everything would be completely fine. But in those situations of real crisis, you just have to go with the flow, and you have to think there's a captain who has been sailing boats since he was six, who knows what he's doing. One of our other crew was an ex-naval captain. You just have to put your hands in their expertise, and panicking is the last thing that you can do. So it wasn't, weirdly, even though, you know, it was quite perilous, it wasn't scary, weirdly. And we had dolphins with us, even through the nights at sea.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, you know, unbelievable. But what you'll see in the next episode on Friday, what was scary is when I arrived in Ithaca. You haven't seen this episode yet, have you?
No.
There was an earthquake. And Poseidon, who of course is supposed to be the god of the sea and earthquakes, he was punishing Odysseus, chasing him down and sending all these storms. And I was lying there in this sort of rather nice converted kind of olive press, and suddenly, you know, everything is sickening. Have you been in an earthquake ever?
No.
Oh my gosh. There is nothing like it. I mean, I tell you, it's the weirdest, weirdest feeling. And all the dogs start barking and then they all stop. Okay, luckily nobody was hurt, so it was okay. But that was doing, you know, experiencing that and experiencing the sea storm, it really made me respect those sailors, those mariners of the ancient world, and it made me realize, actually in a very visceral way, why people wanted to tell stories about them as being the incredible adventurers and survivors and the temptations that were put in their way. But you can imagine, you know, after that bloody storm, honestly, I'd been very anti-Odysseus and thought he shouldn't have taken 10 years to get home to his wife. And he sort of stayed on islands and had massages and, you know, sex with goddesses for every night for 7 years. After that storm, I did not want to leave the island I was on. I really thought, just got to stay here for a little bit.
Well, it's so long. So, I mean, I think at school we the Odyssey was discussed, but like at middle school, so I was pretty young. In my mind, the Odyssey took place over like 10,000 miles, I suppose, because to take so long. But when you see where you went, it's not really. No. It's just within a few islands. So he was really taking his time to get.
He was definitely. He was definitely taking his time. Although there's a big. I mean, we didn't actually do it because, you know, it's so speculative. But there is also an interesting thought that actually what the Odyssey is describing is bitten Greece, but where you love Italy as well, and going right the way to sort of Sicily in the far west, and maybe even as far as sort of Spain or Gibraltar, because a lot of the references feel a bit western in there. But okay, you know, that would have been. I don't think any telly company would have had the budget to have us go all the way to Gibraltar. Maybe I'll insist on it next time.
And what is there any factual evidence of any of it being in any way true? I mean, the is any of it true? Is the siege of Troy true?
Well, you know, there were sieges of Troy 3,200 years ago, 100% definitely. And what I love about, so my first book was about Helen of Troy and actually looking at kind of what's real and what's fact and what's fantasy. And, you know, every year there is an archaeological digging season. Something comes out of the ground that also appears in the Iliad or the Odyssey. So it's not saying that Homer's a historian. It's almost like history by accident. But what he is definitely doing is recording these kind of beautiful, important, epic oral tales of the imagination, but also of life. So, I mean, just sort of tiny examples, like Odysseus is described as having this a helmet made of boar's tusks. And it's described in perfect detail in the way that they're kind of concentrically arranged and the leather that binds them. And boar's tusk helmets, exactly like they're described in the Odyssey, I mean, to the last centimetre, to the last millimetre, have turned up in graves from the period. Right. So we know that that's an example where it's definitely memory. It's not fantasy. So, you know, call me old-fashioned, I don't think there was a whirlpool and, you know, Scylla and Charybdis, and for instance, didn't exist, you know.
Yes.
But, you know, that's just me being very mundane. But I think that there is a lot that was, I think there is a lot that was real as well. So, So it's lovely. It's lovely tiptoeing that delicate line between, as I said, between what is history and what is myth.
Yeah, no, it's a beautiful series, and everything's going a bit weird with my screen. Hopefully, it's all right. I hope everyone's all right at home. I've just had some technical issues here, but I think we're still broadcasting. What was I going to talk about from this? Just threw myself off for a second there. No, but it's a beautiful series, and you do. There's a lot of great stuff in the Greek islands that I had no idea about. So the actual ruins,
yes,
of the are pretty impressive compared to stuff you will see in Italy. You know, there's some pretty full on palaces and amphitheaters.
Yeah, totally. And
where's the best place to start? What's the best if you're going to go? What's the best stuff
well,
to
I mean,
see there?
There's a load on Crete. I mean, so if you really love history, there's just so much. So there's, you know, Bronze Age history and Greek history and Roman and then Venetian and Ottoman. You know, there's a really interesting kind of smorgasbord of history there. Knossos, the Palace of Knossos, so this Bronze Age palace, it's hard to beat that. It was pretty rubbishly reconstructed by Arthur Evans. So don't think it's real if you go there, Richard, because it's all like bright red columns and walls with sort of bright blue paint on them, which was all how he reconstructed it. But you know, that's an amazing place. And these cities, you go into these sort of citadel palaces. And like in one room, so in Pylos, which is actually on the Greek mainland, there was over 2,400 wine cups just waiting to be used for a feast. So, I mean, what a kind of, how amazing. And again, we're talking 3,000, you know, over 3,200 years ago. So the level of sophistication is incredible. Delos is a beautiful island. If you go to party in Mykonos, I wouldn't go to Mykonos if I were you. It's sort of beautiful, but it's become a bit, you know, sort of run by, I don't know, it's become very commercial. But you can get on a boat and go to this uninhabited island of Delos, which was a sacred island, and you could just spend 24 hours walking around there and, you know, in and out of the ruins. So no, it is a very it's a very rich culture, and that there's this tradition of xenia, which is like welcoming guests as if they're friends, and the notion that you should always welcome a stranger, and that comes right the way back from the time of Odysseus, and we see it written about in the texts. And the reason one of the reasons that they were very welcoming to strangers then is because the gods always shape-shifted. So if you opened your door to somebody annoying, it could actually be Zeus in disguise. So that's why you had to welcome them in. But that tradition of xenia, of welcoming strangers, is totally alive and well in Greece. So, you know, that there are riches in terms of how you'll be treated as well as the archaeology.
And I think it's slightly interesting to me, again, a thought from the first episode is you accompany a guy, they're diving down to shipwrecks. But so much of what we get from archaeology comes from a terrible disaster. I mean, Pompeii and Herculaneum are very good examples of that, obviously. But the richness you get as an historian looking at those things, obviously it's not quite as ghoulish as waiting for something terrible to happen and then jumping in, because you've waited a couple of thousand years. Yeah. But it's an odd thing, isn't it, that you're sort of picking over a disaster in order to to find out about what happened.
Completely. I mean, totally. And we're always very, very aware of that. And, you know, you'll see in the Pompeii program that we've done, I have to say, I hate the Pompeii shows that do sort of, you know, a town frozen in time. You think, well, yes, but it was also a death trap for thousands. And you must, you know, we absolutely have to respect. We always have to kind of care about those. I mean, you have to care about everybody, I think, whether, you know, past or present. But it really forces you to, exactly as you say, when you're dealing with, particularly obviously with human remains or with the remains of tragedies. And that, as you say, you know, what's on the seabed, it's basically a huge unexplored maritime museum. So where we were in Greece, sort of very close to the coast of Turkey, you know, there are 54 ships that are wrecked and just in this tiny, tiny little area. And of course, that tells us a huge amount about that world. But you're right. That's, you know, the crews of those 54 ships, a few of them might have survived, the majority won't have done. So, if you kind of approach it from that point of view of respect, and I do a little sort of internal thing to the to people before I go in and poke away. Because as you say, can you imagine for us what a nightmare it would be in 2,000 years' time for a historian to come and pick over, look, this messy study I'm sitting in now, and, you know, to form an opinion on me and my on my life from my remains, you know. So it's a kind of, you know, it's quite a high octane profession in a way. Yeah. So yeah, so you're right. You have to genuinely, you have to bear that in mind, as you have to remember that they're people and possessions rather than just the past and things. I hate it when people talk about objects. They're not objects. They're bits and pieces that belong to somebody.
But, you know, they do those. A tragedy like that where people haven't had the chance to, if a volcano erupted on you now,
yes,
and you hadn't got the chance to die yet, I hope it doesn't happen. It'd be great for the podcast, to be honest, if it happens.
It would.
But I hope it doesn't happen.
Well, as you know, my fire alarm was going off just before.
It was, so that could have been it. But, you know, we would capture you, you know, in the reality rather than in the way you know. So a grave is the way you want to be perceived. Even, you know, even that is not. It's the best of you, isn't it? No one's really putting your worst out.
Yes.
So the amazing thing about Pompeii, I suppose, is it absolutely captures a city.
Yes.
You know, people fleeing from a city, but basically a normal life almost.
Yes,
captured in that instant.
Absolutely. And it's like, did your parents ever say, so would people always used to say at home, you know, put on clean pants in case you're knocked over by a bus? Yeah. Was always like very most important thing. So yes, you're right. They are the this kind of postcard from the past when a snapshot like that happens. That is one of the reasons that Pompeii is so incredibly touching. I mean, when I was there, I got access to the storerooms, and there's all these sort of random little things, like a leather handbag that's decorated with little gold flowers, sort of like you'd see in a kind of Gucci store today, and a little pet monkey that's been left. And then these paint pots, which I have to say, it's one of the few times I've trended on Twitter. I tell you what, I'm just going to stop using Twitter. Whenever I post, I lose followers. And if I just sit there, or if I post pictures of Pompeian paint pots, that's when I trend. It was really funny because it was kind of early on-ish in lockdown, and Pompeii really was trending because I posted these images of these amazing pots of pigments. And then everybody was saying, oh my God, why is Pompeii trending? Is it because Vesuvius has erupted again? So we had this, there was a real sort of serious thing. It's like, no, it's just a few bits of paint. But yes, it would be interesting. So what would be... You'd be captured. It'd be interesting, isn't it? You'd be captured mid... Well, we both would be mid...
We would be. I mean, like, I'd hate... There's so much weird stuff in this. Actually, I was doing Dan Schreiber's Instagram live show, which you did come up on because you were on the Museum of Curiosity, I think. So I mentioned that you were coming on, and he was talking very nicely about you. Oh. But so I've got loads of my most weird stuff around me, the objects that I needed for his thing. But yeah, this attic particularly is just full of all the junk of my many years of making puppets, basically. So I realized when I had to collect my favorite objects, or the objects that meant the most from my life, they're nearly all puppets.
Are they?
So that, so that just shows from the very beginning, there was a little, this is the first puppet I ever had that I remember doing. It's a finger puppet. I remember doing a show to my nan and my mum. This was a donkey, and them really laugh. I was behind the sofa and they were really laughing, and I remember enjoying that feeling of the blood. They were obviously laughing at me for being a little stupid dick. I didn't realise that. I thought I was getting a genuine laugh.
Yes.
They were laughing at me because I was being so cute.
Yes.
There was two of them.
Were there two at that point?
Yeah, but there was at least two. But yeah, somehow I managed to find him, and he survived earless, unfortunately, Dan. So if someone could find that and think, that's, well, in that time...
I know, figurine.
That was a god.
Exactly. They had the donkey figurine that brought great luck.
Turquoise.
To comedians. I know I've got, I don't know if you can see on this kind of bed behind me, I've got all the, somebody's just delivered all the cuttings from the Odyssey show. So I would just look like this most horrific narcissist that all I did was read newspaper things about myself.
Or the most famous, but see, if you were, but see, that's what that thing I was talking about earlier about the fragments found, if all the stuff that gets lost and nothing gets found of it.
Yes.
It's just, you know, if your book, if one of our books survived, if Emergency Questions was the only book that survived 5,000 years' time, people would assume
yes.
That we were the most important authors in the
That's
world.
True.
And they wouldn't know about any of the other stuff. They'd think it was just people asking stupid questions.
Absolutely true. Would. Well, there we are. Well, let's just kind of will a volcano on ourselves now, Richard. Remembered for immortality.
If I had to go, that's the way I would go.
Oh, I don't know.
I'd like to go. I'd like to be, and then you could make a funny shape. You could be doing something. It'd be funny for, you know, future stories to put in the plaster cast, and yes. you've come out and you're playing with yourself or whatever you do.
Don't, mate. Don't. Unfortunately, I know too much about how much they suffered before they died. Oh, my God. They had time to feel fear. Isn't that terrible?
Yeah.
People talk about it being instantaneous. It absolutely wasn't. Anyway, poor sods.
They'd have been dead now anyway.
They are. True.
Screw it. Screw them. I love the people I liked on. What I like again about this series is you're meeting lots of. It's as much about modern Greece as it is about past Greece. So you're going through a lot of the customs and stuff. But was it in Ikaria, the island where there's loads of old people?
Because
yes. And you met a couple of 97-year-old old ladies.
Yes.
Who were, you know, in very good shape. I'd like to go and live on that island, not because I'm obsessed with old women, because I'd like to live to be an old man.
I know.
Eating a Mediterranean diet. That, it looked nice there.
Oh, it was really nice. I mean, that was really magical. I'd never been there before. And it's really interesting because it was communist for a bit. I think it was one of those places that declared itself like a sort of independent state. So it's got this slightly sort of magical world. And they hardly anybody wears watches. Like, even young people don't wear watches. And you say, well, how do you get here? They say, well, you know, why would we need to wear a watch? Because we just do what's important in our day and then we go to sleep. And they seriously, that is how, so it's the most, I think they just live so long because they've got zero stress because they're just kind of pottering around. No, there were lots of really special moments, actually. And the Odysseus of Honey, who has his hives and he goes around by boat. Yeah, that was amazing.
Well, and then they film you with all honey dripping off. They're using you, Bentley. I don't know if you know. They're using you as... They know what they're doing, these directors, all honey dripping off your face. They know what they're doing.
She's a lovely lady director. So, you know,
she knows what she's doing.
Yeah, we were honeying away.
She knows she's playing too. She's the same as the guys who did those Venus statues. They go, get Bentley to eat some sticky stuff. See if it lands on her.
Oh, my God. Well, I tell you, that I would happily do for any price. That Greek honey, unbelievably delicious, as was the wine that I then pressed with my kind of dry, skinny feet and drank.
Oh, yes, that was a... Well, you looked very nervous about drinking that. Was it just because it was... You're drinking that.
I just squashed it with my like sweaty.
I know, but it's your own feet.
I don't suck my own toes, you know. So I kind of, I definitely was nervous, and I also just lost it because it wasn't a double entendre, but the guy who had the winery, I had this thing in it, as you said, in this sort of ancient cup, and I was a bit nervous about drinking it, and he said, "Don't be afraid, put it all in your mouth," and I just. Oh, you know, it was just really bad. I just lost the plot briefly.
Well, you're absolutely fantastic on these shows, and very enjoyable to watch. I'm very impressed with all your. I mean, I didn't know. You know, I've known you for a long time, and we haven't seen each other for a long time. But I've known you over the years and seen you a couple of times. I didn't know you were an OBE. You're an OBE.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty impressive.
Oh, yeah. I actually had to come back from the Greek Odyssey in order to pick up the OBE. And I'd mistimed it. So I'm very brown. If you look in the photos, I'm very brown. And I borrowed everything. So nothing quite matches. And I'm a bit sort of frantic. But yeah, I mean, I'm really chuffed with that because, as we were saying right at the beginning, it's, you know, history wasn't fashionable when we were doing it. Everybody thought we were ridiculous and stupid. And it was, I had to really kind of fight. I was the first female historian, I'm told, to do a history series on the BBC. And it was such a fight to get on with everybody going, oh, you know, who cares? And he'll take you seriously. And so I'm pleased. And we get lovely letters from people saying they always thought history was boring and they weren't interested. And, you know, now they like it from the show. So that was a nice moment.
Who did you get off? Who gave you the OBE?
Princess Anne. So
she's one of the good ones.
She is.
She's my favourite one, actually. There's, I'm not a mass fan of Prince Andrew, but Princess Anne is Princess Anne's one. I've met her.
Yeah, have you?
When I went to Buckingham Palace for a charity thing, and I chatted for her and Ben Shepherd from Tipping Point. We all chatted together.
Nice.
And you know, it was impressive to meet Ben Shepherd from Tipping Point as well. So I was quite. bedazzled by that. But she seems quite together and quiet. I mean, I don't know how much you get when you're just getting an OB. Do they have a chat with you?
We or had
do
a
they
long chat about Bronze Age women, actually. With this real sort of like, just kind of went off on one. And then I sat down and I was very excited because I was sitting next to Olivia Colman, who I really like. And everybody was a bit excited that she was there. So she was there. And also those amazing, the cavers who went and rescued the boys in Thailand.
Oh, brilliant. Wow.
Who are tiny, of course. I hadn't really sort of thought about that. They are giants in my mind. But of course, they're tiny because they have to fit into poles.
Was Olivia Colman dressed as the Queen when she got her? If I'd been her, I'd have dressed up as the Queen from the Crown.
She didn't actually dress up as the Queen from the Crown.
I'd have done that. That would have been brilliant. She's got all the costume and stuff. She could have just done it.
Yes.
It would have been a laugh. Princess Anne would have gone, oh, I get it. And it would have been funny. That's what I'd have done.
They definitely, missed opportunity. There was definitely a bit of banter going on between her and Princess Anne. There was definitely, they were definitely mentioning something along those lines. No, she's
up. She's good. Anne's good. She does it properly.
Yes.
No nonsense. You're not going to fight. She's not going to end up in Pizza Express in Woking. She's a good girl.
She is.
And she's doing the job properly.
Yes.
And I'm a big fan of hers. Oh. So that's all I'm going to say about that's it. That's all I'm going to say about that. Well, look, I'm going to let you go in a little moment. What other stuff is, are you working on more books? Have you got another book coming out?
Yes, I am.
2019, your last one?
Yes, I am. So I'm doing, I'm writing a book about the seven wonders of the world and why they're wonderful and being, you know, kind of, I can't write history unless I go to where it happens. So I'm currently planning my trip to Iraq, which is interesting, I have to say.
There aren't many of them remaining of the seven wonders, or are there?
No.
There's only
the pyramid of Great Pyramid at Giza. Yeah. That's the only one that is really standing. Yeah. And all the others, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. We don't even know if we think they're in Nineveh rather than Babylon. So yeah, no, not. You have to use a lot of imagination, basically. But that's,
you're going to look at a place where it was before.
Yeah, and they go, exactly.
Yeah, I could imagine what that was like.
Exactly.
It was a lighthouse.
Yeah, light, very good. Lighthouse in Alexandria. Rhodes, the Colossus of Rhodes.
The library.
Well, actually, that's not that officially. That was in an earlier selection. But
was it?
Yes, yeah. But
I play a lot of Civilization, so you know they often come up in Civilization on the computer game.
Do they?
You get the wonders of the world, yeah. But they're often, most of them aren't things that probably are the wonders of the world.
Yes.
So that's probably why I know.
Yes. Well, so that's my book job, and then I'm going back out into the world to do a big secret history thing, which is always very odd that you can't talk about history because it's obviously happened. But I'm doing a bit of a cheeky revelation. Very soon.
Cool. And do you find? I mean, that's. I know you've got a family, but you must be away quite a lot to do these.
Yes.
Do these shows? Is that because it's a similar in my job takes me away from home a lot if I'm touring or whatever, not so much around the world, sometimes around the world.
Yes.
Is that tougher or they're quite grown up, your kids?
They are. Well, you saw, again, before we started, they came and helped with my technical, this little sort of flurry of daughters. Yeah.
Whereas mine came up and sang you a song because she thought she was going to be
yes.
My daughter. Last night, she came into the bedroom and said, I want to be in one of your shows. I want to sing a song. I've decided I want to be on the stage. I said, that's good. And then she came back 2 minutes later crying, saying, I can't sleep because I'm imagining people are throwing fruit and what if people throw fruit and vegetables at me? Oh. But then she heard I was doing this, so she came up to sing you a song and made up a little song about that. She made that song up. That wasn't a song. She made that up.
That's super cool.
She's very talented.
Very talented.
But yeah, so mine is... My one's not so much used technically, unfortunately.
No.
As yours were.
She probably is, frankly. She's probably got a better idea than us. So it was a bit of a challenge being away, and but you know, swings and roundabouts. So they occasionally I took them with me, and I did have a hilarious moment once when I'd been filming out in Sparta. And I went to meet my husband and my daughters, and they'd taken a lovely young woman who looked a bit like my daughters to sort of help out while I was away. And I turned up at this hotel, and they thought that she was his wife and I was the mistress. So there was this terrible, like, this mad, you know, dark-haired woman's arrived. She's claiming to be the wife of Batman. Quick, get the message out to him. But no. I mean, you know, we're a very, very happy family. We then go on these kind of crazy road trips together, and they've come and translated Plato. You know, I've always involved them, and that's how we've kind of got through it. But I think they can't wait to get rid of me now. I'm obviously so annoying through lockdown, climbing the walls, wanting to get back out on the road.
Well, I'm glad that hopefully lockdown will be over and there's going to be a second one. But hopefully you'll get out around the world. It's been very nice to see you again,
yeah.
Even remotely.
Yes.
And thank you for the many happy memories I have of you in Dirty Linen that will keep me going for a very long time. Everyone, please check out Greek Island Odyssey on Channel 5, on My5 if you've missed it. Venus and Aphrodite is a great book, as I'm sure the other books as well. There's many more books to choose from, all good subjects. And The Seven Wonders of the World, I'm getting that one.
Cool.
You're going to do the audiobook?
Yes.
Oh, that's what I'll ask you.
Yeah.
If you could have, this is my last question to you, and then you can go after you've answered this. If obviously audiobooks are quite a new thing, but if you could have any author from all of history to read you their own books and an audio book, who would you like to hear read their own books to you?
Oh, that's a really good one. I think
that's a
really good question. I think it would have to be Socrates.
Okay.
because I'm sure he had a really annoying voice. Do you know what I mean? He's one of those people you can imagine like being so clever that there's something really annoying about him. So I'd love to hear Socrates so I could be annoyed by his voice.
It would be interesting.
Interesting.
It would be interesting.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Good luck with everything, Bethany. And I will see you very soon. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Bethany Hughes. Thank you very much.
Lovely.
See you next week. We're with Bill Al-Zafar next week. Please do tune into that. Goodbye. You have been listening to Rahulastapa with me, Rich Terring, and my guest, Bethany Hughes. Thank you to Pest for providing some musical accompaniment to this speaking now, which would otherwise be under just silence, which would be confusing and embarrassing for us all. I'd like to thank Twitch, Ian Twitch, and everyone at Twitch. I'd like to thank everyone at Ian Acast and Ian Acast himself. And I would like to thank Chris Evans, not that one, who has done fantastic work as always. I am indebted to him for what he has achieved. Thank you also to Ben Walker, who puts up the As It Occurs to Me every week for us and helps us with the advertising stuff that we do. And we'll be back as full-time producer as soon as we are back in the theatres, which, when will it be? Probably 2021, let's face it. Carry on listening to us and watching us on twitch.tv/rkherring. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStripe.com production. Head to rahulastapa.co.uk for lots more information on this show. Stick a Kickstarter on the end of that address and you'll maybe be able to see our new Kickstarter if it has started by it yet. Do chip in. All profits will go towards helping live comedy come back from this terrible, terrible year. When will 2020 end? Why is it still going on? Oh, it's not like just... Is that what happens when we do a new year? It'll all reset. I believe it is. Anyway, thanks for watching, you motherfuckers. And listening, rather. Now, go away.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thanks for listening. Go to GoFasterStripe.com for all your Rich Herring download and book needs. Go to richherring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can. And make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.